Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander. And Orion will be with us coming up in just a few minutes. But first, let's take a look at what happened on Wall Street today and this week. On Friday, the main stock indices rose to fresh all-time closing highs as a spike in oil prices supported energy shares and investors renewed their optimism about President Trump's economic agenda. The S&P 500 tallied its fourth straight session of gains a day after the president vowed a major tax announcement, one that he called phenomenal, coming up in the next few weeks. The S&P 500 has surged 8.3% since the president was elected November 8th, fueled by expectations that he will lower corporate taxes, reduce regulations, and increase infrastructure spending, all part of his campaign platform. The rally had stalled amid concerns over the president's protectionist stance and lack of clarity on policy reforms. Kim Forrest, who is a senior equity researcher at Fort Pitt Capital Group in Pittsburgh, said investors were worried that the administration may have gotten off track and was pursuing some other items. But tax cuts seem to have been put back on the front burner, and she says we're looking for gains in the economy at large from this and not just earnings per share for gains in stocks. Running the numbers for all three of the indices, the Dow was up 97 points, 0.48% to 20,269. The S&P gained 8 points, or 0.36% to 2,316. And the NASDAQ added 19 points, 0.33%, to 5,734. The S&P and the Dow closed at a record high for a second straight session, and the NASDAQ extended its streak of record closes to a fourth day. Energy shares gained 0.8% on the S&P. Oil prices rose more than 1% after reports that OPEC nations delivered more than 90% of the output cuts that they pledged to make in a landmark deal that took effect in January. The S&P financial sector ended up 0.2%. The group initially moved higher after Daniel Tarullo, the top Federal Reserve official charged with financial regulation, said he would resign in April, creating further room for the president to reshape the Fed's policymaking staff. The focus on Washington comes as large U.S. companies were set for their second straight quarter of profit increases after several periods of declines. With more than 70% of the S&P 500 having reported results, fourth quarter earnings are on track to have climbed 8.4% on average, which would be the best performance since the third quarter of 2014. Jason Ware, a chief investment officer at Albion Financial Group in Salt Lake City, said we're seeing a pretty solid rate of beats and we're out of the earnings recession. Activision Blizzard surged 18.9% after the video game publisher reported higher than expected revenue and set a $1 billion share buyback program. Its shares gave the biggest boost to the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. Skechers USA jumped 19% after the footwear maker's fourth quarter revenue beat expectations. Sears Holding soared 45% initially, then fell back to about a 26% gain after the struggling retailer said it was going to cut costs by $1 billion and reduce debt and pension obligations by at least $1.5 billion this year. Sears Holding has been down nearly 40% over the last couple of months. Advancing issues outnumber declining ones on the New York Stock Exchange by a 2.6-to-1 ratio. On the NASDAQ, a 2.05-to-1 ratio favored advancers. The S&P posted 48 new 52-week highs, no new lows. The NASDAQ Composite recorded 151 new highs and 22 new lows. Leading the way for the Dow 30 components was Caterpillar, up about 2.5%, and Boeing was the leader for much of the day, but it fell back to a 1.1% gain for the day. Let's bring in our frequent guest, analyst Susan Schmidt of the Westwood Group in Dallas. How'd the week look?
Well, a lot of news, a lot of different things for the market to take in, and we know that that's always tough for the market because they tend to be able to only focus on one thing at a time. The backdrop here has been earnings, and company earnings have been very strong thus far. We're almost done with earnings season now, so we've seen some good commentary, some supportive statements from CEOs. That's helped the market along, and then we've had some back and forth depending on what comes out of the White House, but yesterday we had talk of a phenomenal tax plan, and that made the market very excited. So, again, strength on that.
the president, as you mentioned, not one to shy away from superlatives, used the word phenomenal. What do you think the markets, the traders, think about what is in that plan, or what do they hope is in that plan?
Well, the market is really counting on a reduction in tax rates. Right now, corporate rate, 35-40%. And what market is assuming is a rate coming down to maybe 20-25%. That can make a big difference on earnings. Now, there are other components of this, and so what might be able to be deducted as a cost or as an expense might go away, and that would change things. But right now, because none of those details have been released, the market is just saying, wow, earnings could go up by 20%, and therefore companies are more profitable, so their value should be higher. And the market is really focused on that right now. So any news of that, and yesterday's comment from President Trump was very timely because it brought the market back to thinking about tax cuts. In the days prior, coming into this week and last week, we've been a little bit distracted because there'd been a lot of talk of health care and what's going on, and maybe the tax reform wasn't going to be the first thing up or wasn't going to get done in 2017. Yesterday's commentary from the White House brought it right back to the front burner.
Let's talk about earnings. So far, pretty good?
Companies are posting pretty good numbers, and I think what the market is appreciating is that CEOs are coming out with a very calm outlook on 2017. And the CEOs are all optimistic about potential regulatory reform, tax reform. And so that calming commentary is reassuring the market that CEOs see positives for their business out of anything that might happen here.
The president met with Prime Minister Abe of Japan on Friday at the White House, and that followed a conciliatory telephone call that he apparently had with the president of China the night before. What are we looking for from this meeting with Abe?
Well, Japan also a big trading partner for us. We get a lot of imports from Japan. We are wanting to see is on the global level, the Japanese economy is still very important. The yen is one of the currencies in the world that we look to. And so you want to see some sort of agreeable relationship, if you will, and I think we're starting to see the tones of that. You don't want to start out with contention as perhaps we did with Mexico or, noise around how we're going to deal with Russia or inadvertently calling Taiwan instead of calling, Beijing the first time out. So we want to see some accord being made. We want to see a relationship starting to get established there because Japan can be a big trading policy for us. Japan's economy has its own issues, but they do impact global. And Japanese investors are big buyers in the U.S. stock market. So they're an important support level for what we have, our companies here in the U.S., and this important source of funding.
And let's talk a little more about that One China statement. That had to be helpful to the traders and the markets.
That is, and that's one of the things I think that is comforting the market. Hearing that One China policy come back today was important because remember that China is a huge trading partner and China is perceived as having a more aggressive or active stance in its trade policies. You really don't want to get into a trade war with China.
Susan Schmitz, my guest from Westwood Group in Dallas. Let's talk about the Fed and interest rates. What are we looking at for the rest of this year? Two, three bumps?
Well, the market is thinking that they're going to bump at least twice, potentially three times. And so remember, we've been so focused on what's going on in Washington and what President Trump is saying and all these new plans and issues that are coming to the forefront that poor Janet Yellen, who was the central focus of the markets all of last year, has really just been pushed to the side. She's coming back into the spotlight next week because she gives her two-day semi-annual testimony to Congress. And there's going to be a chance for Congress to ask her questions. She's going to talk about how the Fed is viewing the economy and the state of the U.S. economy going forward. So right now, all the indicators are that the Fed is planning on continuing to slowly increase interest rates and doing that commensurately with the improvement in the U.S. economy. We're seeing good data on the underlying fundamentals. The Fed is taking comfort from that. We saw that increase in December. The market certainly expects to see another increase, two or three, this year. But right now, the market's got that back end loaded. We don't think anything's going to happen in March, the next meeting, but the market does think something might happen in June and then the back half of the year.
Susan Schmitz, always a great guest. She's a senior portfolio manager and a senior vice president at the Westwood Group in Dallas. Looking at some of the ancillary issues affecting Wall Street, Fitch Ratings fired a warning shot Friday about President Trump's economic policies, saying hardline stances on trade and immigration pose potentially serious problems for the world. A Fitch statement said the Trump administration represents a risk to international economic conditions and global sovereign credit fundamentals. U.S. policy predictability has diminished, with the established international communication channels and relationship norms being set aside and raising the prospect of sudden, unanticipated changes in U.S. policies with potential global implications. The most serious implications would involve credit downgrades for sovereign debt. Fitch does not mention the U.S. specifically being subject to a reduced rating, but listed several of its trading partners that could take a hit should negative conditions emerge from the president's saber-rattling on international trade agreements and immigration flows. The Fitch Rating Group is concerned about trade, and the administration thus far has pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, wants to renegotiate NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and has issued harsh rhetoric against companies seeking to relocate outside the U.S. Fitch said the ramifications of its moves will not be known for a while, but the early indications are for disruption around the world. In short, a lot can change, it says, but the aggressive tone of some administration rhetoric does not portend an easy period of negotiation ahead, nor does it suggest there is much scope for compromise. This warning about the Trump rhetoric comes a day after Fitch said the amount of countries carrying AAA-rated debt has fallen to its lowest level in 14 years. As a percentage of all nations with rated sovereign debt, that is the worst reading ever. On the upside, Fitch said the president's plans to cut taxes, slash business regulations, and spend on infrastructure are pro-growth, but restrictions on immigration are viewed negatively. Fitch pointed out that the U.S. and Mexico have the world's busiest immigration corridor. In addition to Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua all have high remittance flows, or payments that immigrants send back to their home countries. The Fitch warning also includes countries that enjoy investment from the U.S. companies and in turn ship goods back to the United States. That list is potentially long and includes Canada, the U.K., Netherlands, Mexico, Germany, China, and Brazil. That is the warning from the Fitch rating system about the president's rhetoric. Meanwhile, do the president's tweets really make much difference on Wall Street? Let's look at what happened this week. The president tweeted about two companies on Wednesday, one praising Intel, another knocking Nordstrom. Shares of Intel ended that day flat. Nordstrom's stock fell initially, but then climbed more than 4%, marking its best and most traded day of the year so far. On Friday, Nordstrom fell 1.5%. The president's habit of targeting specific companies on Twitter has become a major point of focus for corporate America, including Wall Street. Oh yeah, companies are paying attention. Some have teed up and recycled jobs announcements in hopes of avoiding the president's 140-character wrath. But over time, the president's tweets really don't matter. No clear pattern can be derived from the performance of the public companies that the president has attacked or complimented on Twitter. Boeing, for example, which the president slammed over the cost of its 747 Air Force One on December 6th, has rallied about 8% since that time. Lockheed Martin, which he hit over the cost of its F-35 6 days after he talked about Boeing, has fallen about 0.5% since then. Shares of Ford, Fiat Chrysler, Walmart have all climbed since the president sent out positive tweets about them after his election. But so have shares of Rexnord, which the president called out over viciously firing workers and moving jobs to Mexico. The Milwaukee-based industrial company stock has gained about 6% since the president's negative December 2nd tweet. And besides that, it's still taking its jobs to Mexico. According to a Financial Times analysis of Trump Twitter usage since the start of 2017, the president's insults have had almost no effect on the targeted company's share price within an hour of investors having a chance to react. Praise has, on average, resulted in around a 1% bump in the first trading hour, but that wears off in about a day. Ted Mers, news content business manager at Bloomberg, says that Trump tweets cause volatility is unquestionable. Sometimes the market goes up and down and ends the same, but in between, there is volatility. There have for months been talk of algorithms being developed to take advantage of Trump's tweets, but Mers says market movements after the tweets suggest that there is definitely algorithmic trading going on. But no one on Wall Street seems to know, or at least is willing to say, exactly who might be doing it on a scale broad enough to move markets. Bill Hartz is CEO of Modern Markets Initiative, an advocacy group for high-frequency trading. He said, at this point, we're sort of waiting for someone to show some kind of proof or data that actually shows that this is happening and is the result of an algorithm. Google X developer Max Braun has built an open source bot that tracks Trump's tweets. It scans the commander-in-chief's Twitter feed for mentions of publicly traded companies, detects sentiment, and then either buys or shorts the stock, exiting the position at the end of the trading day. It also appears to grab some institutional investment firms it associates with the companies that the president tweets about, like State Street and BlackRock. Braun just started putting money into the algorithm. He plans to donate any profits, by the way, to the ACLU, the NRDC, and Planned Parenthood. But a simulated fund using it has an annualized return of about 59% since inception. That was before the president's tweets on Wednesday about Intel and Nordstrom. Braun said the simulated fund took a big hit after that, but is still slightly up overall. He says he's starting to see the limits of that strategy with Nordstrom, and he says he's always tinkering with his algorithm. But overall, while the president's tweets appear to have a short-term effect, after a matter of hours, if not minutes, it dissipates, and trading around tweets regardless, that can be pretty dangerous. Don't do it with money that you can't afford to lose. You're listening to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group, and Orion Samuelson will be along right after this.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
This week, we talk dairying on This Week in Agribusiness. Ryan Yonkman of Rice Dairy joins us. And we always talk about weather when we talk about grains, but weather is having an impact on the dairy industry.
It is. And on behalf of myself and Rice Dairy, I want to thank you guys for having me out again. But to the weather events we've been seeing, out west and Pacific Northwest is where we've seen a lot of rain and a lot of snow, kind of unseasonal, that we've actually seen really start to affect milk production from the perspective of getting cows sick, which can't go into the milking line and actually turn into products that we're consuming. On the flip side, it's been a blessing, especially in California where the water table is so low. So it's kind of a love-hate for those guys. But the big picture of dairy, it has tightened supply out, supply up on the West Coast.
Well, let's go to the East Coast because things are happening in Washington, D.C. that will have an impact. How critical is the dairy part of the farm bill? Is that something you're watching?
It's something we're watching. It matters. You know, the new campaign, you know, when we talked to dairies about their risks, walking into this year, the new campaign was one of those things that was really a wild card as to what's going to happen with the farm bill, what is the Trump administration going to be doing. And right now we've seen a direct effect happening with Mexico as some of these kind of trade wars almost begin and has taken a direct effect on our non-fat price, which inevitably has been passed down onto the dairy in a bad way. So we're very aware of it. It's a risk. It's not something we're willing to forecast and say this is what's going to happen, but we have to continue to watch it and be prepared really for the worst. If those conversations start to move toward places like China, and other close trade partners like Canada, we just have to be very careful about those things.
And lest we forget, that global market that is now so important to the American dairyman is a very competitive one. Now we have folks in New Zealand who love serving the world with their dairy products.
Yeah, markets continue to grow, and in that comes volatility. Our exports are a big part of what we do now. It's around 15-plus percent of our products leave this country. So everything that happens in New Zealand, that happens in Europe, matters. Whether supply is going up, supply is going down, or economies are weakening or strengthening. Right now, we're coming out of what we would have called a pretty bearish market for the last 2 years, where supply was strong globally. That is starting to shift. European milk production has now been down for about half a year. New Zealand has been down. So we've seen the supply side starting to tighten up. That has not been the case here in the United States.
You mentioned California and that pressure on the West Coast, but other major milk-producing states, the per-cow output and the number of cows continues to climb, does it not?
Yeah, the Midwest and the Northeast, even the Southwest, we continue to fill the hole that's been created out west, and we've watched our milk production actually grow. Last month, we were up 2.2%. So we're kind of getting bailed out in a way that the rest of the world's making less, which has helped our prices sustain and actually move a little higher. But we just keep getting better at what we do in the Midwest and Northeast, and doesn't look like milk production will be turning back anytime soon here in the U.S.
I want to come back to something you said a little bit earlier about the importance of exports to us now. I saw a stat the other day that 1 out of 7 tanker loads of milk leaving the farm in the United States would go into the export channels in some way or another, some dairy product. That's kind of a surprising number, if it's accurate. That's correct, right?
Yeah. Yeah. As we were talking earlier, it matters. Everything that's going on over there, we watch very closely, and we continue to try and grow that market. At the rate we're producing milk, it has to leave our country if we want to be at price levels that are going to put our farmers in positions to continue to make milk here at a profit.
You talked about volatility in the marketplace. Are our producers doing a better job of trying to manage that volatility? Are you working with them, and what are you sharing with them? What are you telling them?
Yeah, so every year, I've been doing this now for 6 years behind the rice dairy desk, we continue to see more and more dairies coming into the market, starting to utilize risk management in some fashion. The government's taken its attempt at trying to provide, margin protection program forms of insurance for them. We continue to see those somewhat fail as far as being coverage that's really meaningful to the dairy. It's very, very vague, if you will. So what we've been doing for dairies over the last year, I would say, is looked at this year actually somewhat optimistically. As we saw world milk supply start to decline, demand does continue to grow, populations continue to grow around the world, we started to view this year as one that we hold plenty of risk in, but there's some good things happening. And after a couple bad years, we want our dairies to be able to have as much upside as possible. So doing insurance structures that protect the floor but getting as much upside as possible is some things we've been looking at for farmers.
Quick question about pizza. Still critically important to the dairy industry?
By all means. Every year that we can read about pizza consumption going up, that's good for us. We want to continue to see that happen. Butter, to flip gears from cheese, is a market we continue to see really, really grow. Different kinds of butter. Butter's good for you now. So there's really been a nice spin on dairy products here over the last couple of years between technology and research and people understanding, hey, dairy is good and it's good for you. We need those types of things to continue to happen.
Well, thank you for sharing expertise with us again this week. Ryan Yonkman of Rice Dairy.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Welcome back to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. I'm Steve Alexander, in for Orion Samuelson. Let's talk about some of the commodities, how they did on this Friday and throughout the week. Beginning with that shiny yellow stuff, gold. Gold futures fell Friday, retreating further from the week's three-month high, thanks to President Trump's promise of a major tax announcement coming soon. That boosted the dollar, and also some better-than-expected data fueled talk of a near-term increase in interest rates. Disappointment among some buyers at gold's failure to break above the $1,245 an ounce level it tested twice this week has also led to some of this pullback. Spot gold was up 0.22% at $1,233.20 per ounce, while gold futures for April delivery dropped by 90 cents, settling at $1,235.90 per ounce. On Wednesday, it touched its highest since November 11th at $1,244.67. The dollar reached a 10-day high against a basket of currencies on Friday, and it was on course for its best week since mid-December, as the president's pledge to announce a major tax plan within weeks cooled some of the market nerves and reinvigorated the dollar bulls. Mitsubishi analyst Jonathan Butler said obviously the dollar has recovered a bit of strength in the past day or so, which has weighed on precious metals. The move above 1220 was pretty convincing, he says, but we didn't get to the next level at 1249, 1250, which would have been confirmation of that bullish trend going back to the start of the year. What we've seen is possibly some disappointed investors turning tail and booking some profit. Let's move over to Texas Tea crude oil. Oil prices on Friday rose after reports that OPEC members delivered more than 90% of the output cuts they pledged in a landmark deal that took effect in January. Supply from the 11 members of OPEC, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, with production targets under the deal, fell to 29.92 million barrels per day, down about a million barrels a day, or a 92% compliance with the OPEC order. The International Energy Agency said the cuts in January equaled 90% of the agreed reductions in output, far higher than the initial 60% compliance with a 2009 OPEC deal. The IEA report notes that some producers, notably Saudi Arabia, are appearing to cut by more than required. On the market, West Texas Intermediate crude rose 86 cents, settling 1.6% higher at $53.86. Brent crude was up a dollar, 1.8% at $56.63 a barrel, after touching a session high of $56.39 shortly after the IEA reported on the OPEC compliance. Brent was on track for its first weekly drop in 4 weeks, while U.S. crude eked out its fourth straight week of gains. Crude has benefited from recent strength in gasoline prices as a glut seems to be gradually eroding. Gasoline futures were trading up 0.9% on Friday. Let's move over to LaSalle Street and the Chicago Board of Trade, where corn futures gained 1% to the highest level since July on Friday, rising on technical buying after a USDA report on Thursday showed smaller-than-expected supplies. Corn for the week was up 2.3%, capping the second straight week of higher prices. The USDA report on Thursday forecast smaller U.S. ending stocks due to increased use of corn in ethanol production. Corn edged narrowly lower after the data on Thursday before resuming its upward climb. March corn climbed above its key 200-day moving average, bringing more buyers into the market. So March corn ends the week at 373¾, up 4¼ cents on the day, and again up 2.3% for the week. Turning to soybeans, March beans were up 7½ cents a bushel at 10.58, and for the week were 3% higher. Soybeans rebounded from losses in the previous session and touched a 2½-week high of 10.63½ a bushel before dropping back. Prices reached their session highs after the USDA, through its daily export sales reporting system, said 140,000 tons of beans were sold to unknown destinations. China, the world's top soy buyer, imported 7.66 million tons of beans in January, the highest for that month since at least 2010, as delayed shipments arrived during the month and crushing demand remained strong. Soy meal futures jumped about 1%, while soy oil edged lower on the meal oil spreading. Wheat futures were high as well. March wheat rose 4 cents a bushel at 447½, and for the week was up about 4%. Wheat futures extended gains to fresh 7-month highs on Friday as investors covered short positions following a USDA report that forecast smaller than expected U.S. and global supplies. Looking at livestock futures at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, cattle futures closed lower Friday, hit by sell stops and fund selling after drifting below technical support levels. February live cattle closed $1.25 lower at $116.40, and April live cattle were down $1.67 at $113.15 a hundred. Both contracts slipped beneath their respective 10-day moving averages of $116.60 and $114.86. During the week, cash cattle in the plains traded at $119 to $120.50 per hundred, steady to $1.50 higher than the week before. February hogs ended up 32½ cents per hundred at $74.55, and most actively traded April hogs closed up 30 cents at $71.75 per hundred. This has been The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. For Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander.